Right, so before I begin, just again, I'd like to thank both Maynooth for having me here today and also to the College of Arts in UCC and the Onomatany Bursary of the Royal Irish Academy for their continued support of this research. Right, so down to the biscuits. Right, so in his seminal work, Crisis and Decline, R.B. MacDowell referred to Henry Lawrence Tyvee as a, quote, extremely proud and sensitive man. Born into a patrician family in Cork, Tyvee was a merchant prince who acquired the Cork Constitution newspaper in 1882 and later launched the weekly edition, the Cork Weekly News. In 1915, he purchased the Dublin Evening Mail and Daily Express. These newspapers served as a vehicle for the espousal of Tyvee's unionist politics, of which this proprietor remained an unshakable proponent from the 1880s up to his supposed retreat from public life in 1922. While Tyvee's sensitivity was confined to a host of philanthropic endeavours in Cork City, his pride manifested itself in a range of political and social pursuits. Tyvee served as the first president and financier of the Cork Constitution Rugby Club and served as committee member of the Cork Industrial Exhibition of 1883, 1902 and 1903. This research aims to trace Tyvee's life and career in broad terms, highlighting his extra newspaper activities as a key component of the production processes of his newspaper group. It seeks to chart the uneasy transition of a unionist like Tyvee into the new Free State, considering also his attempts to obtain compensation from the Irish Grants Commission for losses during the Civil War, and ultimately seeks to engage with the duality of Tyvee's public life as a proud citizen of Cork and a dedicated supporter of the active union between Britain and Ireland. The Tyvee family had a lengthy association with the city of Cork, with one of Henry Lawrence Tyvee's ancestors, George Tyvee, receiving the freedom of the city in 1686. The branch of the family that Henry Lawrence was born into were successful butter merchants, a profession into which Henry Lawrence himself entered and prospered. Tyvee later attributed his success to, and I quote, a close acquaintance with the state of the markets across the Channel. As a merchant prince from a comfortable background, Tyvee was also highly active in civic life. He served as a Justice of the Peace, as well as a trustee of the Cork Savings Bank, Skiddy's Charity and of St Stephen's Hospital, as well as being a council member of the Cork Historical and Archaeological Society. A committed unionist, he acted as Joint Secretary of the Reception Committee on the visit of the Prince and Princess of Wales in 1885, as well as assisting in organising the reception of the King and Queen in 1903. In 1887, H.L. Tyvee was listed as being in attendance at a meeting in the St. Mel's Assembly Rooms for individuals eager to show their interest in the unionist cause and to give, quote, two English Tory members of Parliament the opportunity of giving vent to their hatred of the nationalist and home rule movement in this country, end quote. It was in much the same manner that the Constitution would conduct itself throughout the revolutionary period, with Tyvee constantly warning of the dangers of republicanism. In 1907, the wholesaler's firm operated in conjunction with his newspaper enterprises, News & Co., was sued for libel as the printers of the West Cork People, a Fenian newspaper with a small circulation produced in Clonakilty. The paper was owned and edited by Patrick O'Driscoll, who was the brother-in-law of Michael Collins. Yes, that Michael Collins. So, Tyvee's defence, a Mr. Julian, noted at the trial that he, quote, regretted exceedingly that the time of the court should be wasted in trying that miserable, squalid story. It was an especially hard case on his clients, who had no interest in the West Cork People, save as mere printers of the paper. The proprietor of the paper, Mr. O'Driscoll, simply sent in his copy to be printed, and they printed it, a mere mechanical office. The prosecuting counsel conceded that it was, quote, a curious fact that though the West Cork People purported to be a nationalist paper, it was published by News and Sons, the owners of the Cork Constitution, which of course was an ultra-conservative journal. They apparently wanted to catch the wind no matter what way it blew and gather the shekels from both the conservatives and the nationalists. Of course, that was a very laudable aim of theirs, but it was a rather curious thing at the same time. Having made his fortune in the butter trade, it seems Henry Lawrence Tyvie and his sons were quick off the mark when there was money to be made, as exemplified by their application to serve as agents for the sale of surplus land owned by Cork City Railways, despite possessing no previous real estate experience. Heading into the 20th century, Tyvie's principal concerns were his newspapers. Orby MacDowell notes that the Cork Constitution was circulated amongst the nobility, the gentry, landed proprietors and mercantile classes, and forcefully advocated the unionist cause in the South. The paper claimed that it enjoyed a circulation that covered the province of Munster in its entirety, moving north into Limerick City, into Clare, without penetrating the province of Connacht. It moved across the Midlands and east, taking in Offaly, Laois, Kilkenny, Carlow and Kildare, moving as far east as Rosslare, but curiously bypassing Wicklow and South Dublin. It is doubtful that the paper enjoyed as varied a circulation as it claimed. Indeed, it is unlikely that the Tyvies would have acquired the Dublin Daily Express and its sister paper, the Evening Mail, in 1915, if its Cork titles were really performing that well throughout the country. At the same time, this could have been a way of encroaching on the Irish Times' Dublin dominance by latching onto established newspapers. A degree of hyperbole is certainly at play, though. It does seem likely that the paper enjoyed an impressive circulation in County Limerick, where the landed Browning family were heavily invested in the paper. In Limerick, the paper would have competed with the Unionist Limerick Chronicle. Appearing three times a week, as opposed to the Daily Constitution, the Chronicle often adopted an apolitical approach to the leading issues of the day, or unwillingness to directly engage with heated ones. While reporting on the surrender of the Four Courts anti-treaty garrison during the summer of 1922, the Limerick Chronicle editorialised about the upcoming debate in the House of Commons concerning the Canadian cattle embargo. This bore a marked contrast to the pugnacious editorials of the Constitution's proprietor, H.L. Tyvie. For a number of years, he co-edited with William Ludgate, and in his spare time, Tyvie bankrolled the Cork Con Rugby Club, using the proceeds of a charity game to construct a memorial to those killed fighting for the British Army during the Boer War on Connacht Avenue on the south side of Cork City. The monument was unveiled in 1904 by Tyvie's good friend Lord Bandon, who 5 years previously had recommended Tyvie for a commission of the peace. When the monument fell into disrepair, Tyvie, adopting a nom de plume, printed a letter of complaint in the Constitution. This became a common method of airing his own personal grievances. Now, of greater significance then than Tyvie's personal vexations and vendettas was the preoccupation of Cork's newspapers with the Great War in Europe, which dominated news coverage at this time. Tyvie had a passionate interest in the war effort, as his son George was a combatant, while his daughter, Eleanor Brienne, was a nurse with the Territorial Force. Both George and his older brother, Henry Francis, served on the staff of the Constitution for a number of years and were expected to succeed their father and Ludgate in due course. Tyvie's support for the war extended to advertising the war loan at this time, while in 1917, Tyvie scrupulously removed the paper's popular chess column in January, following consultations with press censor Lord Deasy's, as the paper could not vouch that the chess problems were of, quote, British nationality. Now, unsurprisingly, Tyvie's reaction to the Easter Rising was one of indignation. The Cork Constitution and Weekly News had the most vitriolic reaction to the Rising of the Cork papers, dismissing the insurgents as wreckers and the proclamation of the Irish Republic as arrant nonsense. It should, of course, be pointed out that the Tyvie family had only recently purchased the Dublin Daily Express and its sister paper, the Evening Mail, both of whose premises were occupied by the rebels. Such episodes only served to reinforce Tyvie's resolve to oppose any form of compromise in relation to a Home Rule settlement. In March of 1918, as the Irish Convention drew to a close, Tyvie wrote to Sir Edward Carson to reassure him of his paper's complete opposition to the coercion of Ulster. Now, one of the interesting aspects of media history is considering the extent to which newspapers reflect public opinion and the extent to which they mould it, so it is noteworthy that Tybee reassures Carson that the Southern Unionists are on his side as Tybee's papers paternalistically shape public opinion in his opinion. Right, so as well as possessing a powerful and at times acidic pen, H.L. Tybee could also be the victim of one. There is no mistaking the similarity between Tybee and the fictional editor of the Ballybawn Blazer, Miley, in Susan Day's satirical novel, The Amazing Philanthropist. As well as mirroring Tybee physically, the editor of Ballybawn's unionist paper also shares Tybee's marked opposition to the suffragette movement. It seems likely that Susan Day's impression of Henry Lawrence Tybee, as conveyed by the character Miley, came from personal experience, as in 1891, Tybee's membership of the Royal Society of Antiquaries of Ireland was proposed by the noted antiquarian Robert Day, Susan's father. So, Tybee's appearance then in Susan Day's novel may not be his only literary appearance of note. So, my assessment of the available evidence leads me to believe that the character of Dick Tybee, who briefly pops up in James Joyce's Ulysses, is actually based on Henry Lawrence Tybee, as opposed to Richard Tybee of Summerhill in Cork City, as has been suggested elsewhere. In 1911, there were just 29 Tybees in the country, of which Henry Lawrence was the most prominent and well-known. Henry Lawrence, who was born within a year of Joyce's own father, was closely associated with the game of rugby, with Cork Park serving as one of the first homes of rugby in the city. In Joyce's novel, Dick Tybee appears at Cork Park during the Cork Park races. In Ulysses, Dick Tybee is also said to have nothing between his head and heaven, which could be a quip at the expense of the bald Henry Lawrence Tybee. Furthermore, Tybee was a committed opponent of Home Rule. His brother-in-law was alleged to have been the reputed author of the Parnellism and Crime pamphlet from the Times of London, while one of Tybee's staff members and later co-editor, William Ludgate, was called upon to provide testimony at the Parnell Commission, having previously had a libel case brought against him by William O'Brien. Now, given Joyce's affinity for Parnell, he may have wished to satirise Tybee, who played a managerial role with the Dublin Daily Express in 1902, around the time that Joyce began supplying literary reviews to that paper. So, with regard to contextualising the experience of Southern Loyalists, obviously inclusion in Ulysses was not par for the course. However, the manner in which Tybee has been excluded from post-revolutionary narratives, despite potentially appearing in one of the world's most famous novels, certainly illuminates the extent to which he's been forgotten. Tybee did receive some unwanted attention in September 1916, when the Cork Constitution gave column space to a fiery speech by the Bishop of Limerick, receiving a reprimand from press censor Lord Deasys. Deasys accepted Henry Lawrence Tybee's explanation that it was a mistake that wouldn't happen again. Following a confrontation between soldiers and recently released internees in Ballincollig 3 months later, the Constitution would be censored for magnifying what the authorities considered to be a most trivial affair. While the military found Managing Director Tybee to be wholly repentant, although potentially in breach of Section 27 of the Defence of the Realm Act, Tybee made an excellent first impression on Press Censor Lord Deasys, who believed that the matter should be dropped, noting that Tybee appeared anxious to assist us and distressed at having caused any trouble. While staying on the right side of censorship regulations moving forward, the Constitution could not be accused of being monochromatic in its coverage. A notable aspect of the Constitution's reporting was its utter disdain for the labour movement and the threat of Bolshevism, frequently launching attacks on the Red Menace. When reporting on the sitting of the First Dáil in January 1919, the paper recorded that, and I quote, "A feature of the proceedings was that they were in the main conducted in Irish, though probably three parts of the ticket holders in the hall, and very probably a number of Sinn Féin leaders on the platform, knew as little of the language as they do of Sanskrit." Tybee did, however, have an axe to grind. The energetic and committed support for Sinn Féin throughout the country was given jubilant and exuberant expression, having reached a crescendo in the electoral victory of the party in November 1918. That night, revellers, elated and ill-disposed, attempted to blow up the Boer War monument that Tybee had built, damaging it in the process. With regard to IRA suppression, the Constitution would be fortunate enough to survive the War of Independence largely unscathed. Similarly to both the Skibbereen Eagle and the Cork Examiner, the Constitution would have its presses wrecked by the IRA in early 1920, while editor and publisher H.L. Tyvie would be ordered to leave the country, an order which he ignored. Later in the year, Tyvie would receive a letter informing him to prepare for execution, which was again ignored. The county inspector attributed this intimidation to Tyvie's description of the murder of Mr. Alan Bell as a brutal deed by human brutes. With the ever-increasing hostilities between Crown forces and the IRA brought to a halt with the declaration of a truce in July 1921, Tyvie and the Constitution shortly thereafter found themselves rowing in behind the Anglo-Irish Treaty, particularly with the outbreak of civil war. Tyvie, like many other commercial men of the city, was eager to see fighting cease with immediate effect. This is indicative of the war weariness of the commercial class, which was mirrored by the press. There we are. During the Civil War, the offices of both the Cork Examiner and Cork Constitution experienced a hostile takeover by anti-treatyites following the rise of the so-called Munster Republic, when those opposed to the Anglo-Irish Treaty found themselves in control of much of the south of Ireland. The censorship imposed by the anti-treatyites was as swift as it was rigid, with references to irregulars being replaced with references to republicans over the course of a single weekend. It is ironic, given Tyvie's opposition to female suffrage, that in her diaries, Edith Somerville stated that Mary McSweeney was responsible for editing the Constitution on behalf of the anti-treatyites. Furthermore, despite his mistrust of the labour movement, the censorship of the paper was strongly criticised by both the Cork Trades Council and Richard Anthony of the Cork Typographical Society at the Irish Labour and Trade Union Congress. Rather than operate as an anti-treaty mouthpiece, Tyvie, who had adopted a resolutely pro-treaty position, decided to temporarily cease publication. Weeks later, following the amphibious landing of Free State troops in Cork, anti-treatyites evacuating the city, representing a scorched earth policy of sorts, attacked and destroyed the offices of both the Examiner and Constitution, ensuring that these outspoken critics could not resume their verbal assaults against the anti-treaty movement anytime soon. In an impassioned final editorial, Tyvie had outlined his hope for, and I quote, "the ending of the ruinous warfare which is serving to banish the hopes and destroy the interests of every inhabitant of the country. No matter how prolonged this campaign with its attendant destruction of life and property may be, it must have an end. And it will, when that stage is reached, when it becomes necessary to find some formula under which Irish men of every class can dwell together in unity." End quote. The corollary of the above suppression would be for the proprietors to seek financial compensation from the various avenues established in this post-war period. The Free State's Damage to Property Compensation Act of 1923 provided compensation to people and property injured between the 21st of January 1919 and the 11th of July 1921. The Free State's Compensation Initiative was later expanded to include the post-truce period up to the end of the Civil War in collaboration with the British Wood Renting Commission. The Irish Distress Committee, formed in 1922, offered financial assistance to refugees who felt compelled to flee Ireland and was later reconstituted as the Irish Grants Commission, which focused on the plight of Southern Loyalists between the 11th of July 1921 and the 12th of May 1923. The Tyvie family had been extremely disappointed by the Free State's remuneration of £15,000 under the Criminal Injuries Act, which was later reduced to £7,500 in light of the diversion of funds necessitated by the introduction of the Damage to Property Act. Of this £7,500, £2,000 was paid in cash and the remainder in compensation stock, which recipients claimed wasn't worth very much. The Constitution's claim for £8,000 for disruption to circulation was dismissed on the grounds that by closing the paper himself, at risk to his own life and that of his sons due to the frustration it caused the anti-treatyites, Tyvee alone was responsible for disrupting his own paper's circulation. Eventually, the Irish Grants Commission awarded the Tyvees what amounted to a year's salary to Henry Francis and George Tyvee, while the patriarch, Henry Lawrence, was given double that, which was far less than what they had hoped for. The applications of the Tyvee family were being handled by Henry Francis, Henry Lawrence's oldest son and formerly assistant editor, in light of his father's distressed condition, quote, a result of the mental and physical upset caused by the destruction of his property. Frustrated by the committee's seemingly endless deliberation, Henry Francis complained bitterly to committee secretary Major Reed Jameson, and I quote, the proprietors of the nationalist newspaper in Cork have made large fortunes, while those of the loyalist paper are out of business and begging for help. In Belfast, where loyalty has always been highly profitable, the proprietors of two newspapers have in recent years been rewarded with knighthoods for their services to the Crown, which have incidentally brought them much treasure. In Cork, the unhappy newspaper owner, who risked and lost everything in an unequal struggle for the same principles, received nothing. Highly charged pronouncements such as these were not untypical in these applications, with a chronic shortage of funds encouraging applicants to exaggerate their claims to ensure they received a sizeable portion, if not all, of the sum applied for. In its obituary of Tyvee, the Irish Times noted that the destruction of his paper was, quote, a shock from which he never quite recovered. He was, however, listed as being present at a YMCA meeting in Cork in October 1926, suggesting that he didn't completely withdraw from public life. Tyvee's concern then for the prosperity of the new Irish Free State was exemplified in December of 1923 when he informed Governor-General T.M. Healy that close to £6 million in cash held in securities and to credit of suitors within the defunct Crown Courts lay untouched. This sum, I suggest, should now be under the control of the Irish Free State Courts and, if approved by them, invested in Irish securities for such instance as a future loan, Tyvee wrote. His generous financial advice shows that the newspaper enterprise, rather than being recalcitrant towards the new political alignment, could have adapted to life in the Free State, much like another ex-unionist paper, the Irish Times. The Civil War would, however, have an unlikely silver lining for the Tyvee family. For a number of years, the family operated a wholesale newsagent's business on the side. The destruction of Mallow Railway Bridge during the Civil War prevented Easons, the dominant player in the wholesale market, from transporting goods to Cork City, allowing a dramatic expansion of the Tyvee-owned News Brother & Co. business. This was operated by brothers George Lucius and Eric Reginald for a number of years until it was eventually sold to Easons, while the oldest son, Henry Francis, worked as managing director of the Evening Mail until 1960 when it was bought by the Irish Times. Right, so ultimately, Henry Lawrence Tyvee remained a paradoxical individual. For Republicans and trade unionists, he could be a figure of scorn, while to others, he was the generous philanthropist who delivered cakes to the city's orphanages during the winter. There was, of course, nothing paradoxical in his own mind about his great love for country, Britain, and his city, Cork. While he was fortunate to survive the Irish Revolutionary period, the same could not be said for his newspaper, a fact that was not aided by the inflexible purses of the post-conflict compensation schemes. In the end, like many others, Tyvee was forced to gingerly attempt to acquiesce into the new Irish Free State, battered but unbowed, much like his beloved Boer War Memorial. Sinead.